Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. My guest today, I'm delighted to say, is Jerry Baker, editor-at-large at the Wall Street Journal, author of a fascinating new book, American Breakdown, Why We No Longer Trust Our Leaders and Institutions and How We Can Rebuild Confidence. Jerry, welcome.
Ian, thank you very much for having me.
We're going to be talking a lot about trust and trust having been lost in American institutions. I'm sure we're also going to get on later on. We're going to get on to Henry Kissinger and all sorts of other things that are happening in the news. But let's just begin with the essence of the book. An obvious question, but what was the trigger? I mean, so much has happened in American politics in the last 10 years, and while you were editing the Wall Street Journal, you've seen so much. What made you think this has to be a book now?
Yeah, well, again, so thanks for having me on. I tell you exactly what the trigger was. It was my experience as a journalist. I've been a journalist. You and I have had sort of parallel careers. I've been a journalist for 30 years, a little bit older than you, various different organizations, including the Financial Times, the Times, the BBC, and unfortunately, I'm glad to say, latterly for the last 15 years or so, the Wall Street Journal. And I was editor of the Wall Street Journal for just over five, nearly 6 years. And over that time, and by the way, I've spent most of that time in the United States. I've been here since 1996. Over that time, it became very obvious you need to be a sort of particularly perceptive human being to realize that the level of trust that people had in journalism generally, in the news that they were getting, you know, traditional news sources, but new sources too, was declining. The faith that people placed in news organizations was just collapsing. And it was, again, as if someone was sort of on the front line of journalism, I saw that very clearly from, you know, from my early days, literally back in the, you know, the late 1980s when I started as a journalist working for the BBC, you know, and then through the 90s to the Financial Times. Back then, people had a relatively high level of trust. They would, you know, if they saw something in the paper or they read it in the, or they saw it on television news, they generally thought, yeah, I can probably trust that. And here in the United States in particular, in that period since I've been here, since the late 1990s, that just has gone, that level of trust has gone from very high to really, I mean, just astonishingly low now. So I looked at, so this was very clear to me, obviously, and very much a source of great concern to me as a journalist myself. And so I thought about, you know, what's happened to trust, why trust in media has declined. And then I kind of started to look into it in a little bit more detail. And of course, what you find is that it's not just trust in the media that's declined over the last 25 years. It's trust in public trust in, I mean, literally just about every single major institution of our democracy, of our civil society here in the United States. A lot of this applies, though, as you well know, Ian, to the UK too. But as I started to look at this, then I looked at the, as it happens, Gallup conducts an annual survey of trust and has been doing so for 50 years. Asks people, do they trust, generally speaking, do they have a high level of trust in 15 or 16 institutions, the media, the federal government, universities, big business, the judiciary, law enforcement, you know, science and technology, medicine, all of these things. And it, sure enough, as you looked at it over the last 30 years in particular, across the board, there has just been not just a decline, but an absolute collapse in trust. The media, I think, I'm sorry to say, is just about the worst, seen the steepest decline. But all of these institutions, big business in particular, you know, 30 years ago, a solid majority of Americans said they generally trusted big business. They thought big business would do the right thing. The people who say, they respond saying they now trust big business is below a quarter, it's below 25%. So again and again and again, in all of these key institutions, the public has just lost trust. So that's where I sort of built out from, starting out from the media, built out into this larger question of what's happened to trust in institutions.
So you say in the book that American skepticism of government is, and you're absolutely right, is one of America's great qualities. But how is that almost part of the country's DNA? But what has changed? How has that gone from being a strength to, I mean, is it a switch from healthy skepticism to outright cynicism? And we'll come on to in a moment what's prompted the change. But what is behind it?
Yeah, I think it's a very, very good point, Ian. Yeah, of course it is. And I mean, perhaps, America was founded in a kind of in a revolution of mistrust, if you like, of mistrust or distrust of you know, of a distant king and of a distant government, and all of the, you know, the founding fathers, the creation of the American Constitution, the creation of the American Republic itself was all essentially stemmed from, you know, the very wise insight that actually people couldn't be trusted. I mean, the reason America has this extraordinary constitution that has survived for nearly 250 years is because it's such a, it sets up this, you know, complex arrangement of separation of powers, federalism, the role of the federal government versus the states. All of it is, all of it's infused with this idea that people in power can't really be trusted. And so we have to create systems to ensure that, you know, when they can't be trusted and they can't be trusted, we can still, you know, we can still function as a democracy. So all of these checks and balances were built in partly as a result of mistrust. And it's been a feature of American, sort of American democracy throughout that time. But again, I think what's gone wrong, Ian, and you put it well, is in the last 30 years in particular, we've gone from a sort of a healthy mistrust, a kind of, you know, trust but verify kind of approach that people might have had when to whatever they were being told by the government or the media or by their people in higher, their leaders in higher education or elsewhere, to a position where they simply don't actually believe most of what they're being told. And not only don't believe what they're being told, but actually, you know, don't trust in the in the decency and the basic virtue of people to run these institutions. And that's so we've gone from a kind of healthy level of skepticism to a really corrosive level of mistrust. And I should say, by the way, you asked where does this come from. In some ways, and I write this in the book, this is not a kind of there are some people, this, you know, I dare I say, the what we might call the mainstream media would portray this as a kind of, they'd sort of blame the people approach. They would say, you know, everything was fine, and then suddenly, for whatever reason, and they cite all kinds of things like, you know, the advent of right-wing media or something, you know, suddenly people stopped trusting these decent people who run the government and run the media and run our higher education institutions. I don't think it is, I don't think that's true. I think what's happened, I think a number of things have happened, and I go through them in the book, a number, we can talk about that, the number of the different reasons why trust has declined, but trustworthiness has declined. That's the most important thing. These institutions have forfeited the trust, and I do think the most important reason is, you know, these institutions have been largely captured by an elite, a kind of you know, a liberal progressive, whatever you want to call it, left-wing liberal progressive elite, that has been, you know, that you're again very familiar with this in the UK, a kind of a new generation of people who believe in these kind of nostrums of progressivism, and they're all to do with, you know, essentially it, many of them are to do, much of it is to do with the essential kind of the essential evil of the United States, and what a terrible country it is. And I think that this capture of these institutions by this particular class has driven a wedge between these institutions and most of the people, and I think it's that reason. That's the primary reason. There are many other reasons. That's the primary reason, I think, for the level of mistrust that we see now.
What about the changes in media that we've seen in the last 30 years, the transformation of media via the internet, and the way that that has just, it's been this revolutionary force transforming media? Is that, that's clearly a major factor, but how big a factor do you think?
Yeah, it is. I mean, clearly it is. And again, one of the things I talk about in the book, I try to put this in some historical context. There have been periods in American history when levels of distrust have risen, you know, dramatically, mutual distrust. I mean, you could say, obviously, the period of the 1850s and led to the Civil War was an obvious example of that. The 1960s, interestingly, were an example of that too. But you're right. What I think distinguishes this current period of rising mistrust is the, you know, is the proliferation of information sources, and I think the particular iniquity of this is that it's people. We now have a situation. You know, there's the famous line. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a great Democratic senator in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, he had a famous line where he used to say, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have now is actually the actual sort of disproof of that. You are now entitled to pick your own facts. The delivery of information, news information in particular, through digital sources means that people do, and this, we see this, this is a pattern, whether it's, you know, on your news feed or who you choose to follow on Twitter or Facebook or whatever else, you can basically choose the information you want to receive and block out any information that actually contradicts your beliefs and your views. And that means, so again, what in the context of trust, what we actually have in America, and again, I say this in the book, is that actually there is trust, but people only trust their own side. They trust, if you're a conservative, you trust, probably Fox News and I hope the Wall Street Journal editorial page and others. If you're a liberal, you trust other media sources. You don't. But the problem we have, particularly acute in this country, less so in the UK, although I think it's similar in the UK, is that in the past we may have had sources of information in the media that were widely respected and trusted across the board. And again, you might take a different view of the information you were receiving on the basis of your politics, but you would at least accept that these were the facts, and we would proceed to debate the issues from the basis of the facts. Now we have two different sets of facts. If you're a conservative, you have one set of facts about the world, about, Joe Biden, about Donald Trump, about immigration or whatever. If you're a progressive, a liberal, a left, you have a completely different set of facts. And that, of course, is tremendously feeding this climate of mistrust.
Yeah. Regular listeners will have heard me say this before, but the first time that I encountered this really was in 2014 during the Scottish referendum. And I remember, which was led, of course, by the pro-union side, was led by Alistair Darling, who died today. He was a big figure in UK politics. And I remember one of his colleagues saying to me in astonishment and terror about campaigning during that referendum, where they had encountered, I think, a school teacher or a social worker who explained that they now got their news from Facebook and sort of cut out the middle person and cut out the BBC or other mainstream media and got it from their groups of like-minded individuals and campaigners. And as he put it then, we used to agree what the facts were, but then disagree about how to respond to the facts or what to do, what was the solution. And for the first time, and this is only a decade ago, it's relatively recent, people said, no, I can, as you very well described there, Jerry, just I can have my own set of facts and fence myself off from the alternative. But very interesting on in terms of your analysis of the institutions, because that's one of the really interesting things about the book, that it doesn't just go through the familiar rant or incantation that we're very familiar with in other parts of the media against, as you put it, it's entirely the public's fault. There's clearly something else going on institutionally. And I think, to quote you, trusting someone who's not trustworthy is not a virtue, that's gullibility. And you outline a list of policy areas, and it's really quite something when you see it sort of laid down in paper: failures by leaders of institutions that have lost the trust of American people in the last 20 years, or now longer than 20 years, of various wars in the Middle East, which went wrong, the financial crisis, the response to the pandemic, the mismanagement there by federal government and also by some individual states. What is that? Is it malevolence? Is it incompetence? Is it that it is more difficult now to run government than it was, say, 30, 40 years ago? You suggested that it might be ideological, the rise of a particular kind of governing class, but that can't be true across every state, can it? Because the parties, particularly in the US, are maybe Republicans that are in charge of a state, which also still then exhibits those characteristics you mentioned.
Yeah, no, it's a bit of all of that, I think, Ian. Trust is earned, right? You earn trust, first of all, by demonstrating that you're trustworthy, that your word is good, and people, when you say you're going to do something, and when you tell people something is true, then they can somehow independently verify that it is true. You earn that trust. You also earn trust by performance, right? In a political context, you earn... or indeed in a corporate kind of business context, you get you're trusted if you do the job well, If you don't do the job well, people don't trust you to do it and won't ask you to do it again. And that, I think, is really a key part, a very simple explanation, but a key part of what's gone wrong in the United States over the last 20 years, because we have had, just exactly as you you enumerate there, we have had, frankly, just a succession of really bad outcomes as a result of incompetence, maybe ideological overreach. But again, whether it's the wars in the Middle East, whether it's the financial crisis, whether it's a huge series of corporate scandals that we've had, whether it is, frankly, we can argue about the mishandling of COVID. All countries struggle to battle with COVID, but certainly, the United States didn't distinguish itself particularly well in handling this. All of these episodes over the last 20 years or so have just led people to say, particularly in the context of the federal government, I don't trust the federal government to do the job because everything it sort of touches, it's screwed up. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, obviously. Of course, there have been some successes, but if you look at that, I'm afraid to say, if you look at the first quarter of the 21st century, has been a pretty sorry story for America, as I say, in terms of disastrous foreign wars, a degree of economic stagnation. Now that again, everything is relative, and the US is doing better than Europe in particular and other parts of the world, but in historic terms in the United States, it's done very poorly, and large numbers of Americans now, vast majority of Americans actually say they don't think their children will have a better future than they did, which is an astonishing thing in terms of both in any, it'd be astonishing in any context, but let alone the United States, this country which is sort of defined by its optimism and its sort of opportunism. So yeah, I think it is a combination of incompetence and, as I say, sort of ideological overreach. And I also think one other important thing I talk about in the book is, and I think this has definitely led to an increase in mistrust, is the growth of inequality in this country. I mean, it has been, it is an extraordinary, again, America's always been an unequal society. It's one of its great strengths in that it gives tremendous reward. It rewards risk-taking, innovation, talent on a level that nowhere else is rewarded anywhere in the world. And generally speaking, I think that's a good thing because it's why it incentivizes high performance and risk taking and talent. But the degree to which that inequality has grown in the last 25 years is just extraordinary. Now we've seen, and I think that's part of the reason. I think that's the main reason why so many Americans, as I just said, say they don't think their children are going to have a better future because America has kind of created this, sort of class system now where the rewards to the well-educated, the people who are, who are able to, take risks, who are fortunate enough to come from a background where they get a good education, the opportunities for them are just infinitely greater than the opportunities now for people who don't have that kind of background. And I think that's a key reason why people don't trust the system. They think the system is failing them, and so they have this widespread distrust, but they also don't trust each other. I mean, this is one other thing I talk about in the book is mutual mistrust and how much of a problem that is. So these are, all of these are factors I think have contributed.
How do you fix that? I'm talking about the inequality point there, because we have very similar views on markets. We're both free market people, fans of Adam Smith, will defend the market. But the position that you've just outlined there I hear that more and more from friends who are free marketeers saying something has gone wrong here in the system. Do you think, is it globalization? Is it hyper-financialization of the economy in the last 30 years, the speed of money, technology, cross-border? What is it, and is it possible to fix it?
Yeah, I think all of the above, Ian. And I'd say in particular, it's interesting, there's a really, obviously, as you know, and again, it's going on in the UK too, but there's a really interesting and lively and intense debate among conservatives now. In fact, I actually literally last night chaired a discussion between two of the sort of more prominent kind of iconoclastic conservative thinkers in this country at the moment about the future of conservatism and what's gone wrong, as it were, and why we're in such tumult among conservatives. And you know, there is a view which is, again, which is gaining ground, and it's got, you know, at some extent it's the populist, it's reflected in the populism of Donald Trump, but also some of it, some, you know, I think some of his more sort of thoughtful kind of fellow travelers, members of the Congress like J.D. Vance or Josh, Senator Josh Hawley, people like that, they're, this populism is essentially saying, turning on its head the kind of Reagan-Thatcher conservatism that we've had, that's dominated conservative thinking for the last 30, 40 years, and saying, no, you know, that the mark, they call it market fundamentalism, and they think, you know, it's gone too far, and actually they're in favour of, you know, significant industrial policy, trade unions need to be built up again, you know, we need a, you know, much tougher approach towards international trade, tariffs, all this kind of stuff. I'm a bit sceptical about that. I think there's a lot of, to the critique of conservatism in that argument. I actually think it's a little bit simpler than that. I think we've had market failure, Ian. I think what we have, well, the reason we've had this extraordinary explosion of inequality is the market has been allowed to be dominated by a smaller and smaller group of people. It is partly that is globalization, and I do think something, you know, I'm not sure, I'm not a fan of tariffs, I don't think they work, but I do think that, you know, I do think a sort of national economic policy is very important, and I think people have got to look much more closely at how you do as a government, you know, promote domestic industry and domestic economic activity. I think there is something there, but I think the much bigger problems are, you know, let's sort out what's gone wrong with the markets here in the United States. A particularly strong case: every single sector in the United States over the last 20 years has become dominated by a handful of companies. There's been tremendous consolidation. Huge amount of M&A activity, which has left literally, I mean, there's been some very good books written on this, which have left literally these major, pretty well every single market dominated by a relatively small number of companies. Now, that's not actually the market working as it should be. The market, the government should be there to actually, to protect the market, to protect, you know, the interests of smaller businesses, because that, as we know, once you get an oligopoly, you know, you tend to get price fixing, and you tend to get the consumer is disadvantaged, and you get most importantly, you get excess profits to the managers and the owners of capital, and that's one of the reasons you get this inequality. So I think addressing market failure in all of these areas is really important, rather than, you know, tax increases. Again, some of these people favour, you know, tax redistribution. I don't think that works. I think historically speaking, it doesn't work. But actually, addressing the problems in where the market itself. And by the way, the other thing I should say about it, especially in the US context, it's not quite the same in the UK, is when these companies become so successful and so powerful that they are able to entrench their power through the political system. We, you know, lobbying, huge, you know, companies spend enormous amounts of money in this country on lobbying and getting regulation and legislation that suits their benefits. The regulation and legislation is, you know, when it comes to business, is so often done in the United States in a way, both at the federal level and at the state level, in a way that furthers the interests of these big, powerful companies. So I really, that to me is one of the biggest problems we have. And I think if we, you know, that if we start to address that, I think we will start to reduce some of these tendencies towards inequality. And I think it's a long process, but I think that will start to rebuild trust.
One of the themes of your book, Jerry, is that things aren't that bad. They're bad, but they're not that bad. It's not, as you put it, it's not the Civil War. And you offer some thoughts on objectives or ways to restore that trust, rather than just saying, woe is us, it's unfixable. You talk about, we discussed there, economic inequality and trying to reduce that, and going small with and local with business and politics and media. And you talk about that in terms of what we have now, I suppose, is the hyper-politicization of everyday life, and improving performance and competence in politics and public life. That's a good idea. Could that catch on?
Yeah. Sorry, it's a bit obvious, that one, isn't it? Yeah.
No, I didn't mean to sound sceptical.
No.
It's a theme you sense over here. I mean, there are various projects underway in different parts of the political spectrum in the UK, which are really quite. I'm just meeting with one of the groups which has a project under wraps and to be announced early in the new year recently, which is very interesting and quite limited in its aims, but just about doing what you describe in the book, really just trying to emphasise higher performance, competence, and rebuilding a little bit of administrative confidence in the public sector, and also I suppose in the private sector as well. And then, as you put it, what David Goodhart defines in his book as the somewheres and the anywheres, that you want sort of bridge the cultural gap. I suppose you would describe it in that way. And you think you put all that together, it sounds quite, the phrase national conservative is bandied around a lot. Do you accept that label? Is it in that realm, or is it something different that you're advocating?
I think that's right. I think it is broadly in that realm. I've got issues with, I can never really jump on any bandwagon, because I've always got issues with some of the things that people say, and some of the things leave me quite uneasy about some of the things National Conservatives.
Do you mean the nationalist closed rhetoric, or just the demeanour, which is sometimes very aggressive?
It's a bit of both, actually, but particularly on the former, I worry, for example, I mean, a very, very, in this country again, and I'm not sure if it's true in the UK, but in this country, a very striking feature of the sort of NatCon position is it can be crudely characterized as isolationism, right? And in particular in the context, of the Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, it is a pretty sort of a NatCon article of faith that the war in Ukraine is, America shouldn't be there, shouldn't be spending all this money on Ukraine, and it's got its own problem. So I'm uneasy about that, because I think there's, you and I have had these conversations over the years. I was a strong supporter of the Iraq War in 2003. I came to the conclusion not long afterwards that it was a terrible, terrible mistake, a terrible decision. So I'm not a kind of neocon, the United States should be throwing its weight around the world everywhere. I'm absolutely against that. But I do think that judicious intervention in areas like Ukraine is absolutely vital for U.S. security. So I have those kind of reservations. But broadly speaking, yeah, I mean, I do look. I think that the basic principles of what you and I would probably kind of unite around conservatism, which is giving people the freedom to make their own choices in their lives, is ultimately not only morally the right thing, not only sort of politically the right approach, it actually ends up producing the best outcomes. And I think, while I think there are lots of things about sort of the Reagan and Thatcher era that are no longer relevant, I think that fundamental insight that letting people, have more of their own money to spend, letting people be free from the, diktats of, unions and government and powerful institutions, I think that works. So I'm still very much conservative in that respect, but I just do think that we need many of those tenets of sort of Reagan-Thatcher conservatism. I think just, while they were absolutely vital and timely back in the 1970s and 1980s, just aren't anymore. And the challenges we face today are just really very, very different. And inequality, I think, probably is the most important one. I honestly don't think the United States can really survive as a nation with the levels of economic inequality that it has. It's just not. It's no longer a unified nation. And if that goes on, so I think that has to be overturned. And I don't think classic neoliberal, if you want to call it that, economics really has an answer to that. So I think that does have to be addressed. I do think I'm very, very, both for political and economic reasons, I've long been a skeptic about globalization. I think the sort of the downgrading of the nation state, both in terms of political, i.e. national security, in terms of immigration, in terms of controlling your own borders, but also again in terms of having an economic understanding the nation as an economic entity and being able to achieve its aims as an economic entity, I think are really, really important. And so, yeah, I do incline towards, again, while I try and retain the basic principles of, if you like, kind of basic neoliberal conservatism that we've seen, I do think it really needs radically updating for the particular challenges we face today.
Yeah, and one of the great myths of the whole globalization movement is that, and we've seen it many times in history, that it is claimed that if you increase trade, trade flows, then you it automatically, just naturally, in an upbeat way, reduces geopolitical tensions and diminishes the prospects of war. Well, I mean, that clearly is not the case when you look at the history of the last 30 years. It's not turned out as anticipated, both in the case of Russia, it didn't work, and it hasn't worked in terms of China. Just if we could just move on, Jerry, for 1 second onto the election, because in the middle of all of this is an American election happening next year. And you and I talk about this back and forth several times a month on WhatsApp and various other forums. And I always ask, look, as someone who has a bit of faith in the American system, is there some possibility that things can change and it's not going to be Trump versus Biden? But it just seems to be, and other friends in America tell me the same thing, that it is on course. It's very difficult to see how Biden is stands aside. Trump looks like he's going to win the nomination. It is Trump versus Biden.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have any really good news on that front, Ian. As you know, again, you and I have discussed this on various forums. Look, I mean, of course things, you never say, no, I'm just actually, another column I've just been writing is, you know, what will the Democrats do? Can the Democrats really find someone other than Biden to run? And I think the answer is no. But, you know, one of the things I'm making that is that we just don't know. I mean, you know, we are a year away, just under a year away now from the presidential election. And at this stage of pretty well every previous presidential election in the last, I've covered eight of them or something now, you know, the conventional wisdom turns out to be wrong. And I mean, we can just, you know, go through it. And maybe in 2020, this stage, i.e. 2019, maybe people thought Biden would win, but actually they didn't. They thought it looked like he wouldn't even get the Democratic nomination. You know, in 2015, almost nobody gave Donald Trump a chance. Okay, 2011 was different because Obama was running for re-election, but again, he was facing very uphill odds. 2007, nobody at that point really thought Obama was going to win. 2003, George W. Bush was in the middle of the Iraq War, and it wasn't clear he was going to win again. In 1999, no one had a clue. So you know what I mean. So of course things can change. But as it stands, I mean, it is kind of like we are in this weird situation here where a very significant majority of Americans, I believe, and the polling certainly reflects this, are just appalled by the prospect of a rerun of the 2020 election between Trump and Biden. Again, the polling is very clear on this. People have 30% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Joe Biden, and 30% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Donald Trump. You know, they want a different choice. There's a hunger for a different choice. But of course, you know, in the political system we have here, which is sort of, you know, again, increasingly like the political system in the UK, you know, the candidates, the leaders, are chosen by people who are relatively activist. It's not quite the same as it is in the UK. Obviously, millions and millions of people participate in primary elections here. But, you know, again, because of polarization and the way in which that's developed over the last 20, 30 years in particular, they are increasingly, those voters in the primaries are kind of increasingly unrepresentative of the broader electorate, and certainly of the middle ground. So we end up with, you know, Donald Trump, I think, again, barring something just unforeseeable, and we don't know yet how these trials are going to work out and what impact they might have on him. But the polling is—I mean, he's 50 points ahead in the polls in the Republican primary, and leading in key states. And on the Democratic side, you know, Joe Biden, again, vast majority of Americans say he's too old to be president, want him to stand down. They want a different choice. But again, I mean, I think the problem there is, one is he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to go. And one of my favorite lines was the great John McCain, who used to say, you know, the only known cure for presidential ambition is embalming fluid. and unless the embalmers are going to get to work on Joe Biden in the next year, I just don't see any prospect that he will not, that he will stand down, that he will not run. And on top of that, and this is part of the reason why that's the case, is that the Democrats don't really have a great, you know, the last thing the Democrats want is a major primary fight right now between what would probably be Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris, who would be the two leading candidates, because that would open up all kinds of wounds. It would demonstrate how divided the Democratic Party is. So, yeah, so it, we are, we are stuck with this, frankly, I mean, just nightmare scenario. And I, look, you know, I don't want to sort of, you know, send your listeners away, you know, in sort of suicidal mode, but it's going to be really, it's going to be bad. I don't see a good outcome here. I mean, again, I hope I'm wrong. I hope, you know, in fact, as I sit here and say this in, you know, end of November 2023, I hope in a year's time everything worked out brilliantly and we moved on beyond Trump and Biden and somehow someone like a Joe Manchin or someone like that came through the middle and everything changed. I really hope that's true, but at the moment, I think it's bad. And when I say bad, I mean, I don't just mean the choice is bad and the candidates are bad, which they are. I mean, the country, I think we will see incredible... The thing I'm most worried about... Sorry to sort of just drone on here, but I'll make this brief. The thing I'm most worried about is we are now... And it's kind of back to my point about trust. Neither side now trusts the system. They will not... I don't believe either side will, in practical terms, even if they do in legal terms, in practical terms, will not really accept the result of the election. If Trump wins... Democrats will say, with some justification, hang on, this is a man who led a kind of an insurrection against the government 4 years ago, who has rejected the result of the election 4 years ago, who's, you know, at this point may well have been convicted of a crime, of a federal crime, you know, and he should not be the president of the United States. It's just completely rot, it's unacceptable. We cannot have this man as president of the United States. If Biden wins, you can guarantee... The Trump supporters, Trump himself, and will say exactly what they said in 2020, which is the election was stolen. So I just, you know, this mutual mistrust, this mutual hostility, acrimony, to the point of, you know, almost to the point of mutual hatred, they're going to say even more than they've said in the past, whoever gets elected next year is illegitimate to half the country. And I think that's, you know, that's really worrying.
Just to pick up on the notion in the book that there are answers, things can be fixed. And just to be slightly more positive from this side of the Atlantic about the US, absolutely accept all of that, Jerry, on the absolutely spot on political analysis. But there's also so much going right in the US in terms of technology, elements of the financial system, America's innovative power, its military prowess, cultural heft as well. Now, you add all of that together. If you then take Trump and Biden out of the equation, I know that's easier said than done, and it's probably, as you say, it's probably not going to happen. But if you did have, and it's a sort of generational block, maybe for one last election, you then have a race which would, in normal circumstances, be Nikki Haley for the Republicans versus probably Gavin Newsom. Now, that's not a bad choice, is it, really? I mean, that's a pretty standard... I mean, it's with the grain of post-war American history. Both of them are people who would accept the result of an election and are operating, you know, within normal parameters. What is it that P.J. O'Rourke said about Hillary Clinton when he was asked why he was voting for her? He said she's wrong about everything, but she's wrong within normal parameters. And they are candidates who fit that description as well. So is it potentially just one sort of final generational late 70s, early 80s block on the system, and then below that, am I being far too naive here, there's a generation of new politicians who can change things?
No, I don't think you're being naive. I think you're being rightly optimistic, but I just don't share that optimism. It's obviously Trump is a particular, let's isolate the various characters here. Trump is a particular problem who, you know, again, is essentially kind of trying to lead a sort of an extra constitutional effort to overturn the election and to overturn the last election and possibly overturn the next one too. There is something particularly particularly poisonous about that. And then, you know, Biden has a different set of challenges. But in terms of, I don't think the level of, if you did have, you're right, maybe they would at least accept the results of the election, Newsom and Harris. I'm not absolutely 100% convinced they would. Newsom and Haley, Nikki Haley. Yeah. I'm not 100% convinced they would. I just don't know. But the problem is the stakes, it's actually, it's worse in a way than just Trump and Biden, because it's because in the eyes of their supporters, it's the stakes that are so high. They think that if they lose the election, you know, there's this terrible, terrible phrase that someone used in the context of the 2016 election has sort of caught on. It was the Flight 93 election. You remember Flight 93 was the flight that was one of the flights that was hijacked on 9/11, and very, very bravely the passengers rose up and stormed the cockpit and managed to crash the plane into a field in Pennsylvania rather than into the Capitol or the White House or wherever terrorists were planning to take it. And so this phrase, we have this phrase, every election now is a Flight 93 election, i.e. it's our last chance to save the country from destruction. And whether that's Trump or Trump is the most extreme, as I say, form of it. Biden's people also kind of, very much use that rhetoric. But I don't think that would change because for Republicans, a Gavin Newsom presidency would represent a dramatic, perhaps even more of a lurch to the left than the Joe Biden presidency has perhaps represented. It would, they'd worry that he would pack the Supreme Court. They'd worry that he'd try and overturn, that he'd try and, pursue really radical policies and as a California Democrat, after all, in terms of, whether it's energy or whether it's, the economy, whether it's taxes, all this kind of stuff. And on the Democratic side, people would, it's the same thing with Nikki Haley. They'd see Nikki Haley as kind of as an extreme conservative who would be taking the country in a direction from which it would never recover. So I think, yeah, of course, that would be probably a better choice. But I think the problem is less actually with the candidates and more with the passions that have been aroused and the mutual hostility and mutual mistrust that is out there between these two, increasingly hostile camps.
Presumably, if somehow Gavin Newsom was the candidate, the attack ads make themselves, don't they, in terms of, was he governor of California, but he was mayor of San Francisco, so you, as a Republican strategist, you just have to run footage of what's happening in San Francisco, has been happening in the last few years. I mean, he's, in that sense, although he looks presidential, he's a difficult sell between the coasts.
Yeah, I think that's right. He has a lot of COVID stuff that he's got problems with too. I mean, California really was very draconian, followed very draconian policies during COVID, and he was very much the face of that. And that turned out, A, to be disastrous in the way that we're seeing so many COVID lockdown policies did, but B, also, he was seen particularly hypocritical and, he behaving in one way while imposing stuff on the other. So, exactly. And he is a progressive, highly progressive, to use the word Democrat, as you say. I was mayor of San Francisco and governor of California. And California, has become, unfortunately, in the last 10 years or so, a very dysfunctional, very dysfunctional policy. I mean, you're right. You back to your earlier point. Look, it is one of the conundrums here that the economy has been relatively strong. Now, again, as we sort of said at the beginning, it's relative, relative to Europe in particular. So, as Mohammed Alarian, the economist, likes to say, the United States is the cleanest dirty shirt. It's not great in terms of America's historic economic performance, but yeah, it's still the dominant economy in the world. I think you're seeing, because of what's happened, in China in particular, 5 years ago, it was pretty well conventional wisdom here and around the world that China was going to overtake the United States as the great power. And, this would be the great power rivalry. But because given its sheer scale and the rate at which it was growing, China's economy would, in for all intents and purposes, outstrip the United States steadily. Steadily further outstrip the United States over the next 20, 30 years. That's very much in doubt now. Lots of people, and there's, I think, if anything, there's no consensus, and if anything, probably it's moving towards the view that the US is still going to be the dominant economy. So it is a conundrum. But again, seen from inside the United States, the fact that China's stumbling and Europe is fumbling is all very well, but if you're not achieving the levels of growth of your family income that you were getting, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you still feel pretty miserable.
A couple of quick final questions. The first one from Max Mitchell, who's on the Young Journalist program at Reaction, and has a very good question in terms of the style of the book. And he wants to know how much was it influenced by Christopher Lasch's Revolt of the Elites.
Yeah, it's good. It was a little bit. I read that. I remember reading that. I think it came out in, 1995 or something. It was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah,
it really kind of. I mean, yeah, it influenced my thinking a lot on these issues. I mean, he kind of. Funny enough, this came up last night. We were talking about that book, and so somebody put it very well at this conservative event I was at last night. Said, you know, he kind of predicted Donald Trump really, and 20 years before it happened. So yes, that whole. And by the way, that was remarkable. It was remarkably prescient, not only in that sense, but that was really at the very beginning of this process. I came to the United States in 1996, and I read that book. I can't remember when I read it, not then, but later. But you know, it wasn't evident at that point that this was the direction that the United States and indeed the West, to a large extent, would take this kind of seizure of the, you know, of the commanding heights, as it were, of the culture and the. And the political system and indeed everything else in the country by these progressive elites. That's been an important influence for me in a lot of my political thinking.
I often wonder whether it's really at root about secrecy or the culture of secrecy, which is, you know, in the 1880s or 1890s, there wasn't much that the American state, you know, which federally was pretty small. There wasn't much that it really needed to keep secret. And then the story of the 20th century is the accumulation of state secrets, which are obviously for valid reasons. I was reminded of this, you know, watching Oppenheimer recently. So the critique from not just the conspiracy theorists, but the critique from radical left and from populist right that the government is keeping stuff from you. Well, the government does for perfectly valid reasons in the 1940s start to keep rather a lot from the populace, and that perception then growing through the 70s with 60s Pentagon Papers, Watergate, series of scandals which are about secrecy, and the leitmotif is they're lying to you. There's a way in which the state operates secretly, and they don't let you, they don't let you in on the secret. And the elections are just a kind of jamboree laid on for your entertainment. You can see how that—it's not a critique I agree with—but you can see how that has a very powerful cultural effect.
You can, I agree with that, and I would add all of that is absolutely true. And I would add one further thing, you know, building on that sort of historical development that you've just talked about there, and that's the kind of the growth of the national security state, particularly after 9/11. I mean, that's, you know, very, these things, unforeseen consequences. I think that, you know, America passed the Patriot Act, the Congress passed the Patriot Act immediately after 9/11, which opened, which A, you know, kind of highlighted, I suppose, if you like, the sort of the secrecy of government by actually, you know, protecting the secrets even more, but also by enabling, you know, really for the first time in American history, in ways that are still subject to constitutional challenge, you know, a degree of surveillance of its own citizens and indeed others too. And you know, 9/11. I do think, you know, we can talk about the sort of psychological impact of these things until the cows come home. But I think the both 9/11 itself, which was this astonishing shock to the American psyche, the first time really in American history that America had been attacked in such a scale on its own soil, and then the reaction to 9/11, which was this, you know, highly interventionist. Surveillance kind of operation in which, you know, we were told for years that, you know, and probably rightly, that we were under threat, that we were under security. That's carrying on today. And by the way, you're seeing that in things like, well, again, one of the institutions that is really mistrusted by large numbers of Americans is the FBI. And part of that is because, you know, this is what they do, sort of domestic counterintelligence. So I think, yeah, I think all of that has to be considered as, you know, very much a significant part in creating this climate of mistrust.
Yeah, final question. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about in terms of the global global context, Brexit, what's happening in German politics, Dutch politics. There's something happening in Europe. Maybe we'll talk about that next time when you're over in the UK. But just a final question on Henry Kissinger and just your thoughts on, obviously, Kissinger died today, was 100 years old, extraordinary geopolitical legacy. How do you view him?
Well, I'm actually, you can read my Times column on this tomorrow. I'm writing it literally as we know. I'll get back to it as soon as we've done this. I've got about an hour and a half in which to file it. So I've been working on it from this morning. I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to say in it, and what this is what I think. I think it is a testament to the sort of the power, the cultural power that the left has on our kind of on our public discourse, that Kissinger's got this kind of very mixed, kind of controversial reputation, had this mixed controversial reputation, his legacy. I'm already reading the obituaries about, you know, mixed, controversial, polarizing figure, you know, hated by the left and regarded as a war criminal, and everybody quotes the Christopher Hitchens stuff and all this kind of stuff. I think it's a tribute to the power that the left has over our cultural discourse, because of course there were bad things. I mean, you know, he was National Security Advisor or Secretary of State for 6 years, a very long period of time. And of course, in a very turbulent time in American diplomacy and foreign policy, and of course, you know, he was responsible for things that, you know, that we can condemn. I mean, whether it is, you know, support for the Indonesian government, you know, putting down the, you know, in the slaughter that took place and putting down the, you know, the rebellion in East Timor, whether it was the carpet bombing of Cambodia, which, of course, he was very much associated with. Nixon was obviously responsible for it. Some, you know, you could argue some of these episodes where the US, you know, aggressively supported horrible regimes in places like Chile and Argentina, and Kissinger was part of it. So of course, all of that has to be weighed in the balance in terms of the overall judgment. But if you think about what he's actually achieved in office, the three signal achievements I think he had in office were the ending the Vietnam War, ended messily in the end, but he through Nixon, but through his advice, extracted the United States from a war that had cost 58,000 American lives, hundreds of thousands of other lives, always threatened to blow up into a much wider geopolitical confrontation that could have led to, you know, really, really serious global war. He, through his diplomatic efforts, was able to end that war. Secondly, the agreements that Nixon was able to reach, again, in large part thanks to Kissinger, with the Soviet Union, the Ballistic Missile Treaty, various other treaties, that period, you know, where, again, you know, I'm just about old enough to remember that period. This was a very dangerous time in the world, and to be able to achieve a degree of détente and to de-escalate the tensions, Kissinger has a very, very good claim to being personally responsible for a large part of that de-escalation. And of course, the third and most important achievement was the outreach to China, which completely changed the entire complexion of the Cold War. It drove a wedge between China and Russia to a large extent, which was crucial in terms of helping the United States win the Cold War. It created, you know, a diplomatic rapprochement between, you know, two nuclear powers. Again, it significantly reduced the risk of escalating conflict in the various, you know, in the various sort of Cold War confrontations that were arising around the world. So I think he has an I think the balance, you know, again, of course, there it's the ledger is, you know, is two-sided, as it always is, but I think the overall balance of his life, of his career, is, you know, we have to say that, one, you know, he helped to keep the peace in a very, very, very dangerous time for most of the world, and two, he helped the United States win the Cold War, and in the process liberate hundreds of millions of people, literally, from, you know, from the yoke of communist tyranny. And I just think that's, you know, that's a pretty good legacy.
Jerry Baker, thank you very much for joining us.
Ian, thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Jerry Baker, author of American Breakdown: Why We No Longer Trust Our Leaders and Institutions and How We Can Rebuild Confidence. You've been listening to The Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want to get my weekly newsletter, go to the site www.reaction.life, sign up and become a subscriber. You also get all the other work from our team, the daily briefing, lots of columnists, lots more besides that. Until next time, thank you for listening.